Good morning to you. We're welcome those of you who, as Tyler mentioned, meeting through broadcasting this out through virtual reality to those in our immediate community and our Lake Shore Road Baptist Church, those in East Tennessee, and those in the rest of the country and beyond. We thank you for clues that you give to us in terms of meeting with us on these Sunday mornings. We're in the midst of a series, God with Us, and we looked at the staggering faith of God with that patriarch Abram on a wild and windy mountain, Genesis chapter 22. And we looked at, last week, the story of God with us as we see this man wrestling with God, Jacob. Jacob in the darkness of the night in the river valley, somewhere between home and somewhere between nowhere. Today we come to look at a new passage, God with Us. And this is one that centers around choice, chance, or the hand of God. Amidst the sand dunes and the shadows of the pyramids, Will Willimon gave me the clue to the title for this sermon with his opening phrase, and I've just said it in a context. Choice, chance, or hand of God. Amidst the sands, the sand dunes, and the shadows of the pyramids. Resilience and courage are like initials carved into the trunk of an oak tree. Indelibly, they mark the journey and character and lives of some. One of those, I would argue, is William Ernest Henley. He was born in the British Isles in the UK in 1849. He battled tuberculosis from a young age, and even in his adolescent years, they would drain the tuberculosis abscesses that had touched and afflicted his body. And he went through great pain and even had his left limb amputated below the knee. Henley was a good friend at one time, of Robert Louis Stevenson, the Scottish author. And Stevenson borrowed the image of Henley for his character, Long John Silver, in Treasure Island. This British literary critic died at the age of 53 in 1903. But he had a signature poem, which many of you have heard before, entitled Invictus. You know well the last four lines. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishment the scrolls. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. Are ye? Choice, chance, or hand of God? As you look back through the turns and the twists and the plot of your life from this day, how do you describe it and how do you understand it? With that backward glance, do you see the story of your life unfolding by decision, by choices, or do you see your life as random, as circumstance, as chance, as contingency or luck? Or do you see God's hand, the hand of God looming large over the landscape of your life? Well, let's read from the text this morning, Genesis chapter 50, reading from verse 14 through 21. After he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers. and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong which we did to him?" So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father charged before he died, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' But Joseph said to them, 'Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones.' So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them." When we read this last chapter of Genesis, chapter 50, in this book of origins, in this book of beginnings, when we come to chapter 15, it seems like we have slipped into a theater to see the final act. The patriarch Jacob is described in graphic imagery at this moment of death. If you look at Genesis 49:33, it says, "Jacob drew up his feet into the bed and breathed his last." The patriarch is embalmed in Egypt, and the Egyptians mourn and weep for this Jewish patriarch for 70 days. After the days of mourning, Jacob's body is almost and all but given a state funeral. An entourage of elders and nobles and political dignitaries make the journey with this body and Jacob's body and Joseph and his brothers up to the land of Canaan to bury the patriarch according to his wishes. Joseph and his brothers return to Egypt, for there is famine. And as they return back to the place where there are granaries with wheat, the brothers become fearful, unsettled, and trepidation and anxiety grip their hearts. Will this now be payback time? Will Joseph come with exacting revenge on their past treachery? And we see in the words that we read this morning, Joseph's response of forgiveness and reassurance, Joseph's attempted settling of his brothers' hearts with these magnificent words in Genesis 50, verse 20. Joseph's words of forgiveness and reassurance tower over the Joseph narrative, Genesis chapters 37 through 50. "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." The Joseph story is a complicated one. It's one of family intrigue, and there is cover up at every stage. But in a sense, we have to go back a generation before that, because there we see Isaac and Rebekah who set the stage in a sense. For Rebecca brings to the story favoritism of one son over the other. She loves not the eldest son of Isaac and herself, Esau, the hairy one, the one with red hair, But her heart leans towards loving the younger one, Jacob. A family flaw, a parent's flaw, to set one off against the other. Well, that tray of favoritism is continued in the next generation. Jacob plays favorite too. He has what the Germans describe as the word Vorliebe, favoritism. A love that forward leads, this love for Joseph rather than for his other sons. And this sets up a rift. This sets up complicated family intrigue in this Jacob dynasty. Joseph is seen as separate from the brothers. And if to exacerbate the rift and the chasm between the siblings, he gives to Joseph this coat of, we call it many colored colors, multicolored. That's really not an accurate translation. Rather, it is a long robe. That's the translation. A long robe with special sleeves. That creates more tension between Joseph and his brothers. He struts the stage, precocious, an upstart. And as if to make matters even worse, he comes one day parleying dreams of destiny and self-indulgence. Joseph the dreamer had a dream last night, and I dreamed that we were out in the fields, he says, and the sheaves of wheat, mine grew up, and these other sheaves of wheat knelt down and bowed to mine. Had a dream last night, and there were the sun and the stars, and the sun and the moon and 11 stars, and they bowed down before me. Heady, arrogant, Sigmund Freud would have had a field day with Joseph's dreams. When Jacob one day sends Joseph out to inquire about the welfare of his brothers, he doesn't realize the danger in which he's sending this young favorite out into. Go to Shechem, he says, and come back and tell me how your brothers are doing. Joseph finds no brothers at Shechem. A stranger tells him they've gone beyond to Dothan. And when the brothers at Dothan see that Joseph is even further out of the circle of paternal protection, Jacob is at a distance. Just as Cain killed Abel out in the fields where there was no one. Now the brothers see this precocious upstart walking towards them in this long robe with special sleeves. The simmering hatred is now a change of mood in the part of the brothers, and they begin to think with all kinds of darkness. Let's murder him. Let's take care of Joseph once and for all. But there's intervention, one of the brothers. In a moment of sanity, Reuben says, let's throw him in a pit. And so they seize their younger brother and throw him in a pit. And while they're eating, there on the horizon, here coming towards them is a caravan of Ishmaelite traders. And now Judah comes up with a plan. To absolve ourselves from blood guilt of murder, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites, and they do so for 20 shekels of silver. And then the plot is hatched even further. Let's take a male goat, which they do, and they slaughtered it, and they took that tunic, that robe that belonged to the favorite son, and they smeared blood of the goat across this article of clothing. They come to Jacob, the one who was a deceiver, and he himself is now deceived by his sons. They present a robe and they inquire of the aged patriarch, whose robe is this? Is this Joseph's robe? And they let the father, the patriarch, make his own deduction, which they knew would be the wrong one. The father concludes, a wild animal has devoured my favorite. He's struck with inconsolable grief because in his mind and in his heart, Joseph is dead. The dreamer is dead. in the father's destiny and life, and a cloud of darkness settles over the family. In the meantime, Joseph has come to Egypt. There's been a breathtaking up and down in the saga of Joseph over the years. We notice first that he is bought by Potiphar, captain of the Pharaoh's bodyguard, who soon recognizes Joseph's skill set and ability and promotes him to be steward and to be the manager of his household. But we read in Genesis 39:6 that Joseph is not merely an astute man of acuity and administration and organization, but he is fine of appearance and form. And Potiphar's wife notices and makes advances towards him, which he rebuffs with moral tenacity. He continues to rebuff these advances until a plot is hatched by Mrs. Potiphar, and he ends up resisting her advances on a trumped-up charge in the royal palace. Think about it. Choice, chance, or hand of God? What would have happened if Joseph had remained in Potiphar's house? Would he have ever met in that royal prison the cupbearer of the Pharaoh and the baker whose dreams Joseph translated and interpreted? Would he have ever been brought out of that prison to come and to translate and interpret the troubled Pharaoh's dreams? The turns in the road, the journey into the shadows to reach the destination and the dreams that God has for us. Reaching Egypt, Joseph soon lands on his feet, soon lands in the jail, languishing for several years because the cupbearer has forgotten about Joseph until the Pharaoh has dreams that no one can interpret or translate. Then he thinks back, the cupbearer, to the one in jail, that Hebrew, Joseph, who summoned to Pharaoh's court, translates the dreams and is virtually given the keys to the kingdom of Egypt, from pit to palace. But wait a minute, the jail is the stepping stone, the hand of God. The jail is the stepping stone to the palace. Joseph is the vizier, the prime minister. With financial authority, he bears the royal signet ring, the scarab, the beetle that signifies his power. Social prestige. He wears royal clothing and regalia. He drives the chariot reserved for the second one in command, like Air Force Two. He's marked as a man of authority and political power and position. We know the name well, the Russian novelist, the dissident, the Nobel Prize winner Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who wrote painfully of his spiritual awakening in his classic, The Gulag Archipelago. In his loneliness and in his pain, he shares this awakening of his heart and his spirit. And I quote his words: "In the intoxication of youthful successes, I had felt myself to be infallible, and I was therefore cruel. In the surfeit of power, I was a murderer and an oppressor. In my most evil moments, I was convinced that I was doing good, and I was well supplied with systematic arguments." He continues, "And it was only when I lay there on rotting straw that I sensed within myself the first stirrings of good. Gradually, it was disclosed to me that the line separating evil and good passes not through states, not between classes, not between political parties either, but right through every human heart. And through all human hearts. So bless you, prison, for having been in my life. The hand of God. When the reality of the famine strikes Canaan and the region, Joseph's siblings make their way down to Egypt looking for food. The brothers do not recognize Joseph. It's been 2 decades, and here is Joseph speaking Egyptian, making oaths in Egyptian, dressed in Egyptian clothes. The limelight, they would never have expected him to be on central political stage in this land of the pyramids. They go through interrogations with the Egyptians, plots and episodes of intrigue as Joseph tries to find out more and more about them. Are they spies holding hostage Simeon and threatening to hold Benjamin hostage, placing the cup of silver in the sacks of grain? We know the story well. And then when Joseph says that he will keep Benjamin as ransom while they go back to their father Judah, in an incredible triumphant message and soliloquy in Genesis, says that I would rather take my life and offer it up as enslavement than break again the heart of my father. The emotional dike breaks. Joseph is held back in check through these incidents and events. He can no longer. Genesis records for us how he wails and he weeps as he reveals to them in Genesis 45:3, I am Joseph. Intrigue over. I am Joseph. Is my father, he asks, still alive? Joseph plays the divine card, the hand of sovereignty, and he assures his brothers in chapter 45, you sold me, God sent me. Choices, chance, the hand of God. The providential hand of God is clear in the mind and the heart of Joseph. There's no rancor, but the offer of forgiveness and embrace. The brothers make their way now back to Canaan to bring Jacob down to see his son. You can imagine the tender scene recorded for us in Genesis 46, verse 29. As Joseph leans upon the neck of the aged patriarch and weeps and weeps. We saw earlier in chapter 45, verse 2, that when Joseph sees his brothers and the emotional dike breaks, he wails and he weeps the loudest. The whole palace can hear the bent up, spent up, released emotion of years of brokenness. And he weeps the loudest. Now, as we read the reunion, as Joseph embraces his father Jacob and feels across that span of 22 years of absence the frail ribs of his aged father, now he weeps, not the loudest, but the longest. Joseph is a young man who feels deeply. So does Jacob, for Jacob comes now, and this is his nunc dimittis. Now he is ready to die. He thought that the news of Joseph's death would and mourning would take him to Sheol. But over these years of waiting, Jacob, the one who wrestled with the angel of the Lord at the Jabbok River, the one who looked into the face of God and lived, now the Jacob who has encountered his son, Joseph, is ready to die. his life fulfilled, but God gives to him another 17 years before he will draw up his feet into his bed. Now we're at our text where we started. Don't panic, I don't have too much more. Now we're at our text that we read this morning. Jacob is buried in Canaan. The ancestral body and bones are deposited in the cave of Machpelah, which Abraham the patriarch has purchased as a burial ground. Joseph's brothers now fear revenge, recrimination, retribution from Joseph. For the one who held the family system together has passed from the scene. Now the politics of family are fair game and scrambled. Has guilt and doubt, as Chuck Swindoll writes, slipped in the unguarded gate of their memory and robbed them of their fragile peace? The brothers share a concocted story about Jacob's death instructions to pass on to Joseph from the patriarch when he passes. Look at verse 17. These are the words they claim Jacob gave to them. "Please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father." The concocted story, fabricated again. The enduring cycle of guilt that plays out in our families, played out in this dynasty. The only one who can break that cycle is the one whom they fear most, Joseph. Again, Joseph weeps. We all know from our personal experience about the concussive consequences of our sin. The consequences of the brothers' betrayal of Joseph lingers across the narrative of the Joseph story and fractures the family. The brothers' guilt and view of family relationships is so distorted by their past behavior that they cannot see the forgiveness and the kindness of the younger brother being offered to them. Their brothers, the brothers limp like Jacob limped. Jacob limped because he had wrestled with the angel of the Lord. The brothers of Joseph limp, metaphorically speaking, and physically and emotionally speaking, because they do not accept the freedom of forgiveness that Joseph offers them. The brothers fall down before him after this concocted message and say, "We are your servants." Sounds like their bowing down of the sheaves and the stars has come to fruition. Joseph's dreams that he gave to us at the beginning have now seemed to be realized. We've gone in a full circle from the ending back to the beginning. Joseph's tears are a clue to his thoughts. There's no thought of retribution here. His response to his brothers, as we read in this text, is sandwiched in verse 19 and 21, framed with the words, "Do not be afraid." He inquires with rhetorical question between that reassurance, "Do not be afraid," this question, "Am I in God's place?" Would I ever assume he's saying, "The autonomous decision to decide what is good and evil and on your guilt. I have many years before laid down and deposited this guilt at the feet of God." That's God's prerogative. Who am I to place God out of the way, to displace God? Can I take God's place? There's irony here. Joseph says, "I cannot," but the very fact that he will not displace God or place himself where God is shows us the patient bearing in the image of God, who is so forgiving. and so welcoming of those who are broken. In refusing to take God's place, he in fact is in God's place, demonstrating the character of the God of the fathers of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and now Joseph. To use a phrase from Winston Churchill, this is Joseph's finest hour. Joseph understands the character and the power of the God of the fathers, that God can shape human malice and out of that bring his purposes to bear, that he can create life out of death. Martin Luther put it so graphically when he expressed this principle: God can shoot with a crooked bow and ride the lame horse. The brothers intended evil. God worked that evil for good, for life. Joseph calls a spade a spade. He says, "You planned evil against me, but God was able to reshape it." The Hebrew word here is hasah. God was able to redesign, refashion that evil malice and that human malice and turn it into a life of purpose and victory. He comes finally with practical affection. You are forgiven. You need to be reassured that I will look after you in these remaining years of famine. At the end of verse 21, we read that, "For you and your little ones, do not be afraid." When we look at our lives, we look back and we tend to think of our past, maybe some of us in glowing terms, and maybe we indulge in a little bit of cover-up, selective memory, hopefully not deception. We tend to think back of our home as being happy, and for many of us it was, of loving, caring parents, of brothers and sisters that were adoring of us. But the Joseph story is a real story. It is about a real family like many of our families. Villemon writes, "In any family, even the best of them, there is envy, there is uneasiness, there is unfairness, there's competition, there's rivalry, there's strife, there's struggle, and even in some families, the threat of violence. Home is not just the alleged haven in a heartless world. It's also a place of deep feelings and dark secrets, of love and hate mixed," he writes, "the sideward glance, the downward cast of eyes, the anger that bubbles, the rage mixed with popcorn by the fire, presence around the tree." End of quote. Why is it in family that sometimes the ones we love the most seem to be the ones that hurt us the most? And we, they. The one who is your brother, the one who is your sister, casts you into the pit. In the Joseph story, God does not sit in the bleachers, callously indifferent to what is playing out in the Joseph saga. The Genesis narrative suggests that the hand of God is operative, is greater than the brother's evil, is working out his purposes even in the midst of their evil deeds, that there is a creator, an author that is greater than the actors on the human drama. The divine dream lives, and God's dreams will not be stumped or thwarted. If life is all about my choice or my decision, if life is all about random choice or random chance rather, if life is only my choice, my decisions, or the roulette wheel of chance, then I am hopeless and helpless. If life is all up to us and that's it, choice or chance, then we are indeed doomed. Be sure to understand in this Genesis story, the lifeline, the thread of God's providence, which is an incredibly difficult concept. I'm not in any way suggesting that everything takes place in this world is authored and sponsored by God. Not at all. God cannot do evil. There are too many murderous brothers that lurk around our lives and our worlds to ever indulge in that kind of falsehood. But I do believe that in the Christians' lives, despite the inscrutable purposes of God, despite the tragedies and the crises, that God can take the dreams, the broken dreams of his people, and in a mysterious providential way bring it into symmetry and harmony again. It was Augustine who described this providential hand of God as a chicken yard where chicken prints are left in the mud, seeming randomly to go this way and that. And yet through the eyes of faith, if we look at this illustration through the eyes of faith and strain our eyes, perhaps we can see there is a pattern, there's a coherence, there's a form, there's a design. As we look back at the journey of our lives, we see the providential hand of God. You may not see the hand of God in the moment, this moment, the present moment, the crisis that you are living in. But as you look back in retrospect, how can you not see God's hand shaping and moving the journey of Joseph? We might call it the gracious intrusion of God in our lives. Peter Hodgson said, "The doctrine of providence has, in the words of another theologian, been in deep recession for several centuries because of the impact of the natural sciences, historical relativism, and the experiences of radical evil in our modern world." But he goes on to say, perhaps providence is experienced at the time when the person is empowered to go on, to start over afresh in your life after a debilitating defeat, struggles, sufferings, or disappointments. Shakespeare wrote, perhaps wiser than he knew, in Hamlet, "There's a divinity that shapes our ends. Rough hew them how we will." End of quote. We will make mistakes in the journey of life. We will fall into the ditch. We are not perfect. We will carry on our backs and in our hearts and in our minds this carnal nature until we breathe our last. But we can come with genuine sorrow and fall on our knees and cry out to God for repentance and realize that God can turn the page and introduce a new day and a new chapter in our life story. God does not intend for us to live maimed lives after we've knelt at the foot of the cross. Do not allow guilt to sap your spiritual strength. Forgiveness is real. It cost Jesus his life to offer it to you and to me. Do not mock his forgiveness through doubt. Accept it. Lloyd John Ogilvie wrote so well, "The grace of God is greater than the grief of life." But guard your heart when you are tempted to overload and to place guilt on somebody else. Refuse to rub their nose in the mess that they have made of their lives. Remember George Robinson's timeless hymn, "I am his and he is mine. Loved with an everlasting love, led by grace that love to know." Joseph was led by grace. He spoke by grace. He forgave by grace. He remembered by grace. He offers grace to his brothers. Get on your feet, brothers. Go and live freed by my forgiveness. God meant it for good. God sent his son. His son was rejected on that Friday on a brutal Roman cross. We intended it and meant it for evil. Every one of us drove that spike into the cross. But on that Easter Sunday, on that Easter dawn, when the shafts of light were coming through over the horizon in Jerusalem, there was a resurrected Lord, a God who had raised him, who took that human evil and staked a claim on humanity's hearts forever, tilted history in the right direction because he meant it for good. Grace. God hands, the hand of God, meaning it for good. Let us pray. God, help us, as we prayed before this message, to walk with a new understanding of your love, your presence, your peace, your power, your promise in our lives. Thank you for reminding us that we do not live in a world where God has been bracketed out, but we live in a world where Jesus touches our lives and presences himself each day. For it's in your name that we pray. Amen.